The United States Army Air Force is off for Berlin.
Ready for war, sir. Ready for war.
The magnificence of the courage and fortitude of the Korean people defies description.
Other battles were raging in the streets of Saigon.
We today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam.
There has been unusual American air activity in the area of the Persian Gulf.
We are determined to knock out Saddam Hussein's nuclear bomb potential.
Afghanistan is a war that we had to fight and we have to win.
This is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join our honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories. From World War II...
This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War.
...to the present day.
In Afghanistan and Iraq, 50 million people are now living in freedom.
Now, the American Veterans Center and Radio America present Veterans Chronicles.
In this episode of Veterans Chronicles, host Gene Pell talks with retired U.S. Army Colonel Jack Jacobs, recipient of the Medal of Honor for valor in Vietnam. Jacobs, who had also received 2 Silver Stars, 3 Bronze Stars, and 2 Purple Hearts, began his military career as a second lieutenant in the 505th Infantry Regiment of the 82nd Airborne Division. He served 2 tours in Vietnam as an advisor to South Vietnamese infantry units. Colonel Jacobs' story begins as he reflects on his early years growing up in New York City, and he tells us what inspired him to want to serve his country.
I'd like to begin these things by talking about your childhood and early background and some of the influences that came to play in your later life and what they were.
Better hurry, because as I get older, I forget things. So speed right through it.
But you're from New York.
From New York. Yeah, I grew up in New York City. I lived in Brooklyn while my father was overseas in the Second World War on a street called Hart Street, not far from Tompkins Avenue. And Tompkins Avenue had a trolley that ran down it. And you could ride the trolley and then get a transfer to the subway and do it all for a nickel back then. And I remember as a kid going to Ebbets Field to watch the Brooklyn Dodgers play, and it cost 35 cents to get into the bleachers in those days. And baseball players didn't make very much money. Now, they all had winter jobs and second jobs. I remember Carl Farrillo was an iron worker and worked on building the World Trade Center. In any case, from time to time, you'd find, they didn't have cars. Nobody had cars. Baseball players didn't get paid enough to have cars. From time to time, you'd be on the subway with one or more infielders or outfielders or pitchers and so on from the Brooklyn Dodgers. But that was a long, long time ago. In 1949 or 50, the city of New York built projects, housing projects, low-cost things, mostly for returning veterans to live in. And we moved into a project in Long Island City in Queens. And I went to PS 83 in Queens, which may now be a rehab center for all I know, and went to public school in New York City until we wound up having too much money. My father made maybe $2,500 a year. And that broke the barrier, and we got thrown out of public housing and bought a house in New Jersey. So we moved to New Jersey. I went to high school and college in New Jersey and then came into the Army through ROTC. I had a great time when I was a kid. Things were different then. It was almost as if mothers were on a duty roster. There'd be one mother or other hanging out of the window yelling at you to not do something. And it didn't matter if it was your mother or somebody else's. But it was worse if it was somebody else's mother.
I remember it well.
So you behaved yourself when you could until you were yelled at and you shaped up for a while until you didn't behave yourself again. But there was something of a communal and community spirit that I don't think exists today in a lot of places. But it was very comfortable, as I recall. When I was a kid, I would go to... I would go eat at my friends' houses all the time, and it happened quite by accident. I lived in a neighborhood that was predominantly Italian and Jewish. As a matter of fact, I don't remember meeting a Protestant until I was 11. Nobody knew what that was. All my friends, I'd go hang out with them after school, And as I was getting ready to go home, whatever house I was in, my buddy's mother would sit me down at the kitchen table and say, Jackie, you got to taste this. Tell him to taste. She'd been cooking all day, making something, spaghetti sauce, lasagna, jambot, something. And, of course, the taste turned out to be an enormous plate of whatever it was she was making. And I'd wolf it down. It was delicious. My mother wasn't that good a cook. By the time I get home, I wasn't hungry anymore. This happened day after day, and eventually my parents took me to the doctor to find out how come I never ate supper at home. Nobody ever. Whoever's listening to this, do not disclose this information. But we had a very close community in New York City back when I was growing up.
Now, you went to Rutgers and Army ROTC.
Yeah.
Did your father's service in World War II have any bearing on your decision?
Yeah, sure did. I went through ROTC because I thought then, and I still think today, that everybody who's lucky enough to live in a free country owes it something in the way of service. My father had served in the Second World War. Everybody had served in the Second World War. Indeed, when I came into the Army in 1966, which to me doesn't sound all that long ago, everybody in the Congress had been a veteran. Everybody. Today, I think the percentage is something around 20%. Bad idea. If you don't have the experience, sometimes you don't make very good decisions about that. And we have made some very poor decisions about the use of our military instrument, at least partially because people didn't have military experience. But I thought it was my responsibility and my honor to serve my country. I was going to go into the Army for 3 years and get out and go to law school. But after 3 years, I really liked the Army. I loved the Army, as a matter of fact. And I thought the mission was important, but I really would miss the people. And today, now that I've been retired about 25 years, I was in the Army for 20 years, and now I've been retired about 25 years. When people ask me, what do I miss the most about the Army? Well, I miss a lot of things. I miss the responsibility, the authority, the opportunity to do something good for the country. But most of all, I miss the people. Really, really miss the people. But my initial idea was that it was my duty and honor to serve for a little while. The little while turned into 20 years, but that's the way things are sometimes.
After you received your commission, where did you next go?
My first assignment was in the 82nd Airborne Division. I was in Charlie Company, 2nd Battalion Airborne, 505th Infantry, at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And the Army had a hard time, I think as it does now, trying to juggle the requirements of going overseas and fighting on the one hand, and the requirements of teaching everybody and sending them to school on the other. And as a result, there was no slot for me to go to either infantry officer basic course or ranger school or jump school. So I went directly from being a student, having been commissioned out of ROTC at Rutgers University, now a brand new second lieutenant with no training whatsoever except that which I got in basic at Rutgers in 1965 at Fort Devens, Massachusetts. I went directly from that to being a second lieutenant in an airborne company. Very fast learning process, I can tell you. But that's what the Army does. You have to learn very, very quickly. My first company commander was a guy named Hunter Shotwell. And I guess if your name is Shotwell, you name your kid Ammo or Front Sight or Sling Swivel or Hunter or something like that. And he was a 63 graduate of West Point, where he played lacrosse and hockey, two games designed for people to hit each other over the head with sticks. And he had the false teeth to prove it, by the way. I think he was an All-American lacrosse player or something, but he was a good guy. And he had just come from Vietnam. He was later to go back to Vietnam, and a mortar round got in a bunker with him and killed him. But in 1966, he was my company commander. And after a suitable discussion, don't forget now, I'm not airborne or anything. I haven't been to jump school. He said, okay, get out of here. And I said, well, which is my platoon? He says, you must be joking. There are only three officers in this company, you, me, and one other guy. And so you're going to be the platoon leader for all the rifle companies, which is something astounding for somebody who didn't have any training. So I became responsible for absolutely everything in the lives of about 140 men after being responsible for nothing. There's nothing like military service that gives young people authority and responsibility at a very early age.
I agree.
I had to jump right into it.
When did you first go to Vietnam?
I got orders to go to Vietnam. I came on active duty in 66, summer 66. About 6 months later, I got orders to go to Vietnam and to go as an advisor, which meant I wasn't going with my battalion, which was going to go overseas and be on jump status, too, which paid you an extra $110 a month. But I was going over as an advisor. I called up the branch guys who were issuing the orders for officers, and I said, why are you sending me as an advisor? I don't want to be an advisor. I want to be an airborne soldier. I said, oh, you got a college degree, so it means of necessity you're more intelligent. I said, no, that's nonsense. And you got to be really smart to be an advisor. I said, I don't want to be an advisor. I said, tough, you're going to be an advisor. And I left in September of 67 to go be an advisor to an infantry battalion, which I joined shortly after getting to Vietnam.
How could you be an advisor if you didn't have that much experience yourself?
Precisely, boss. And it didn't matter. They needed advisors. And we were increasing the number of regular American units in Vietnam. So all those had to be manned with officers and NCOs. And they had a shortage of advisors. I'll tell you how short they were. When I got to my assignment, I was advisor to the 2nd Battalion, 16th Regiment of the Vietnamese 9th Infantry Division. I was a second lieutenant, and the senior advisor is supposed to be a captain. No, I've got to be a first lieutenant. Senior advisor was supposed to be a captain. I was the senior advisor. So not only was I an advisor to this battalion, I was the senior advisor to the lieutenant colonel who was the commander. So it's you can imagine how much influence I had on this guy. I did from time to time.
After the break, Jack Jacobs discusses his first deployment to Vietnam, including his recollection of the Tet Offensive and the military tactics employed by the Allied troops.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. When just a recent college graduate, retired U.S. Army Colonel Jack Jacobs served as a senior advisor during the Vietnam War, a position with great responsibility for someone of such a young age and with little training. Jacobs quickly proved his worth, however, becoming one of the most decorated veterans of the war. He continues his story now, discussing his role in the Tet Offensive in 1968, which became one of the most deadly years in the war for U.S. troops. Jacobs describes his initial encounter with the North Vietnamese during that campaign of surprise attacks on the Allies, who were not fully prepared for the ambush.
Let's go to your second deployment in Vietnam and the incident for which you received the Medal of Honor.
Well, actually, it was the first time I was in Vietnam. I went back after I got the award. My award was for...
That's correct. I beg your pardon.
My award was for 68. I went back
because they weren't going to let you go back.
They didn't want to let me go.
Yeah, well, let's start over.
So that's worth talking about.
All right. You're in Vietnam now. Tell me about the what led up to the Medal of Honor.
We were in almost constant contact during the Tet Offensive in 68. And we knew that we were getting closer to... taken out the unit that was bothering us most of the time, the Viet Cong unit that was bothering us most of the time during Tet of 68. But we were in contact all the time. And there's a rule in using the military instrument of power is that you're supposed to do two things. First, exploit success. You're not going to exploit failure. And if you do have success, you want to pile on. And second, toward that end, if you lose contact with the enemy, you better reestablish it. Well, we had fought for quite a while and inflicted a lot of casualties on the enemy, taking a lot of casualties ourselves. Battalion was only about half as strong as it was at the beginning of the Tet Offensive. But we'd lost contact with the enemy. My battalion was attached to Kien Phong Province, having been detached from the division, the 9th Vietnamese Infantry Division, we were attached to Kien Phong Province, and therefore the province chief. The province chief was a Vietnamese Army colonel. Everything was military, including the administration of all the political districts like the province. And so we worked for the province chief. The province chief's intelligence apparatus came to the conclusion that it knew exactly where the enemy was located we were trying to find. And they worked up a big military operation to go reestablish contact and get the bad guys. And they had it down to a 6-digit grid coordinate, which is, you know, that's within 100 meters. They thought that they knew almost exactly where these guys were, where the enemy was located. And so they worked up a big operation. The operation was supposed to go something like this. My battalion, at dawn, was going to land from river assault craft, riverine boats. Looked like landing craft or Higgins boats. We're going to land at dawn on the north shore of the Bosoc River. Bosoc's one of the two principal rivers of the Mekong River complex. And move due north towards this point. And at the same time, the 43rd Ranger Battalion, a Vietnamese Ranger Battalion, was going to be inserted by helicopter at a point to the east of where we were moving and move due west perpendicular to our movement. And we were going to squeeze them off. They were going to get mashed by my battalion coming north, and they were going to get mashed by the Ranger Battalion that was heading west. The problem was that... there was a spy in the province chief's headquarters. And so the bad guys knew exactly when we were coming, where we were coming from and to, what strength, and all the rest of it. They knew everything. And they had about 3 days to do what they actually wound up doing, and that was to establish an enormous L-shaped ambush right where we were going. And you got to realize that the Mekong Delta, dry season, is just large, huge open areas, so there's no cover and concealment. Very little in any case. And our scout platoon hadn't been doing its job. They were supposed to be to our front and flanks, as you know, but they were not. I don't know where they were, but I can tell you they weren't to our front and flanks. Staff Sergeant Ray Ramirez from Raymondville, Texas, and I were accompanying the two lead companies of the battalion. We were supposed to be protected by the scout platoon ahead of us and to our sides, but we were not. And as a result, the two lead companies, and Ramirez and I, we were the first things to encounter the enemy. They let us get within about 50 to 75 meters of their positions, and then they opened up with everything that they had. And we were all killed or wounded in the first 10 seconds of the engagement.
Thank you.
When we return, Jack Jacobs recounts his experience after being ambushed in the Tet Offensive and the courageous acts of valor he witnessed among his comrades, many of whom were severely wounded or lost their lives in battle.
This is the Radio America Network.
Government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
We remember 24 hours a day.
We study the news and history.
We assemble information.
We speak out.
And we listen to you.
And we don't forget that every pleasant minute of this freedom we owe to those who defend it.
So, here's to life.
The freedom of conscience.
And liberty.
Thank God Almighty!
And the pursuit of happiness.
Veterans Center. This is Veterans Chronicles.
The surprise Tet Offensive made 1968 an especially lethal year for American forces in Vietnam, resulting in over 6,000 deaths and many wounded soldiers, including Army veteran Jack Jacobs. He continues his story of survival in the face of enemy attacks and the valor exhibited among the men he served alongside, along with his being awarded the Medal of Honor and how it impacted his life.
So you've just been ambushed. You're wounded.
I wounded. Most of the other guys were killed. We had quite a few wounded. They caught two companies out in the open with machine guns and automatic rifles and rifle fire, mortars, rocket-propelled grenades. It was a right mess. I was wounded in the head. I had a very bad head wound. Ray Ramirez, my sergeant, had three sucking chest wounds. We had a lot of guys who were out there who were in very, very bad shape out in the open. But we also had a lot of killed in action right away. In the end, we wound up going around the enemy and flanking them. And that's how we relieved the pressure, using mostly hand grenades and rifle fire. Relieve the pressure on the troops who were caught out in the open, many of whom subsequently died of their wounds. We couldn't get them all out. Couldn't get them all out in enough time. As a matter of fact, the helicopter, it was a Navy gunship, actually, came down, risked his life and the life of his crew and his aircraft to come down and rescue us. Rescued me and Ramirez and four Vietnamese, three of whom died in the aircraft on the way to the hospital. So there was a lot of, let me tell you something, there were a lot of valorous acts that day and a lot of valorous people. Almost all of them didn't survive the action.
Well, tell me about the medal itself.
Well, there's something that goes through your mind in the middle of any difficult situation, and it goes something like this. It's a real mess, and something needs to be done. If you don't do it, who's going to do it? I think that and it's not just in combat that this happens. This happens in a lot of human enterprises.
Well, I like that it's a quote from Hillel, I believe.
I
paraphrased a little bit.
Yeah, very. Because it sounds great in Hebrew and doesn't translate very well into English. It goes something like this.
If it says, now when?
Well, it starts off by, this is why it doesn't sound good in English, but it sounds great in Hebrew, which I can't recite to you because I've forgotten after, 55 years. But directly translated from the Hebrew into the English, it says, if I am not for myself, who shall be for me? If I am only for myself, what am I? And if not now, when? But I think that goes through the mind of everybody in any kind of military action in particular. It's a bad situation. Something's got to be done. It's got to be done now. If somebody doesn't do it right now, then everything is going down the drain, and you get the it motivates you to do something. I get asked all the time by cadets. I teach up at West Point. Cadets, both at West Point and in ROTC, and soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines I meet because I go to speak to them all the time. Will I be able to do it when the time comes? And I say with a great deal of confidence, yes, you will, because I've seen almost everybody in combat do his duty. People are worried they won't be able, they won't have the courage. They will. Trust me, they will. They all have the courage to do what's necessary when the time comes, because they're doing it for their buddies. You know, we fight to achieve the mission, and we fight for the country. But when the bullets and shrapnel start flying around, we really do it for each other. In the end, we really do it for each other.
Do you remember the details of crossing that fake rice paddy several times?
Just like it was yesterday. I remember just like it was yesterday. Right in front of the lower leg of the L-shaped ambush. They were right in front of us in concealed positions. I remember being lifted up with what seemed like a big giant hand and slammed back down into the ground, and blood was pouring out of my head. Ramirez was on the ground next to me, and I saw he was very badly wounded. Brought him back to a wooded area, the last wooded area where we were located, had been located, which offered a little bit of protection. Did not just an imperfect, but a completely useless job of trying to plug up his wounds with his bandage. Realized that I myself was wounded, and I was wounded pretty badly, and I poked around on my head to find out where it was, and I found a hole right above my right eye. So I came to the conclusion that was, boy, that's where all the blood was coming from. So I took out my first aid pack and put it over that. But that wasn't a bad wound. It was on the top of my head, which I had paid no attention to. But there were other guys out in the open, and I went out and got them. But I had to shoot a lot of rounds in order to keep the heads down of the enemy. And then it dawned on me, after doing this a couple of times, I'm rushing out into the open with all these guys shooting at me. What I need to do is eliminate the bad guys who are shooting at me first. So I went around the flank, and I took some hand grenades, and I managed to eliminate a couple of the bunkers that were closest to me. But every time I went out there, I got shot at again anyway. So, and I brought back quite a few soldiers, but a lot of them, about half of them died in the end. But quite a few of them lived, and but I remember it all like it was yesterday. And then I got very, very tired. I had lost a lot of blood. I got sick. I felt sick. Felt like I had the flu. And anybody who's lost a lot of blood, I tell you, that's mostly the way it feels. And I felt really tired and sick. And so I sat down to get my breath, and I couldn't get up again. My boss, Major Nolan, and the other NCO in the battalion, Staff Sergeant Yyoli, came up and took care of me and Ramirez and got us out of there in the end. They performed valiantly, too, let me tell you. And I got an email from Sergeant Yyoli from Hawaii just a couple of years ago, about 2 years ago. Maybe even last year, saw me on television. So I saw you on television, tracked me down, and emailed me. I said, what are you doing? He says, oh, I'm still out here in Hawaii drinking beer on the beach, you know. 70 years old, just relaxing. If you talk to a guy named Sammy Davis, a Medal of Honor recipient, which you may have, who is the real Forrest Gump, who's a young artilleryman, defended his 42-man position, only 9 of whom were not killed or wounded at the end of the action, against 1,500 enemy. He'll tell you that you don't know real love until you've been in combat. That's where real love is. When you love each other, you think enough of each other to risk your life for each other. And they all do. We all do. Right now, there are kids out there, right this very minute, there are kids out there doing that right now, risking their lives for each other because they're all in the same boat and they love each other.
How did receiving the Medal of Honor change your life?
It changed it dramatically. Because you realize very, very quickly that you don't represent yourself. You represent all those people who are not around, who perform valiantly and are not here anymore. Somebody once asked Bob Kerry, who used to be governor of Nebraska and was a senator from Nebraska for two terms, now runs a new school university in New York City, a SEAL, Medal of Honor recipient, yeah, lost his leg in Vietnam, asked him, what does it take to get the Medal of Honor? He says, well, you have to do something. People have to see it. They have to be able to write, and they can't hate you. So think about all the people who performed valiantly and nobody saw it, or people saw it and they themselves were killed. Or they wrote it up and the recommendations were lost, thrown in the garbage on purpose or accidentally. So for everybody who wears the Medal of Honor, there are thousands and thousands, and in fact, the fact is millions of people who did their duty and are not around to talk about it or are not asked to talk about it. And so Medal of Honor recipients probably will all tell you the same thing. They don't wear it for themselves. They wear it for all those who can't. It changes you because you are no longer, I am no longer Jack Jacobs. I'm Jack Jacobs Medal of Honor recipient. I don't represent just me. Everything that I do or fail to do does not reflect just on me. It reflects on the medal, and it reflects on the people who are in uniform, and reflects on all the people who ever were in uniform. It changes dramatically the way you think about yourself and about what you represent, more about what you represent. It changes you profoundly for the rest of your life. When I got out of the hospital, they sent me to Fort Benning, Georgia, to run an OCS company. And I ran two cycles of OCS candidates, commissioned about 400 new lieutenants. It was a real challenge because I had to activate the company and then deactivate the company a year later. There's nothing more onerous than the administration and logistics for trying to put together an organization and then take it apart. And it's really annoying. But anyway, I did that. I commissioned a lot of lieutenants, and a lot of the lieutenants who are now retired businessmen and retired colonels and generals and so on give me a call from time to time. And we talk about the old days when we were about the same age, but I was a captain and they were candidates before they became officers in the Army. Lost a lot of those, too. Everybody went to Vietnam, and some of those got killed. Many of them got very badly wounded. I then went to the Infantry Officer Advanced Course, and from that, I went to graduate school. The Army sent me to graduate school. They sent me to graduate school mainly because I asked for it. Friends of mine in my class were getting letters asking if they'd like to go to graduate school. And I didn't get a letter, so I called up. I said, how come I want to go to graduate school, too? They said, if you can get into a graduate school, you can go. And I did. I got it back into Rutgers and got a graduate degree. Well, I went from 1970 to 1972, and my utilization assignment was supposed to go teach at West Point, but that wasn't supposed to start until 1973. So the infantry branch said, well, you got to do something between the time you get your master's in 72 and the time you're going to go up to West Point in 73. We're sending you to Korea. I said, I don't want to go to Korea. Why not? Well, it's cold, for one thing, and I don't like cold. I was born in August. I like warm weather. No, I'm not going to. I don't want to go. You're going to Korea because you have to have a short tour, only a tour that's a year long. I says, you got to have some other short tour. So the only other short tours around are going to Vietnam, and you're not going to Vietnam. I said, why not? Because Medal of Honor recipients, we're not sending Medal of Honor recipients back to combat. But we had this argument for what seemed like hours. But eventually they agreed that I could go back to Vietnam. Don't forget, I got $95 a month extra, and I had a wife and two children. But I wouldn't be able to be in combat, and as a result, I was going to be assigned to MACV headquarters. Well, in the end, I wound up getting myself assigned by calling up somebody I knew to get my orders changed to go to the Vietnamese Airborne Division. I joined the Vietnamese Airborne Division, which was in combat up in Quang Tri Province. And when the infantry branch and the Army found out about it, they were not very happy about my doing that. but it was too late. And I served with the 1st Vietnamese Airborne Battalion until the American troops were completely pulled out of, combat troops were pulled out of Vietnam in January 1973. And then I went up to teach to West, at West Point.
And then you became an investment banker.
Oh, yes.
Now you're with MSNBC.
Now I spent time with all of which, every single thing that ever happened in my life happened by accident, including all the things that you just mentioned, which proves yet again that maybe Woody Allen was right when he said that 90% of life is just showing up.
Okay. We thank you for coming in and visiting with us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for your service.
And yours.
Jack Jacobs' service in Vietnam played an active role in shaping his life as he continued his career in the military after the war, spending a total of 20 years with the Army. After his second tour of Vietnam in 1972, he spent 3 years teaching international relations and comparative politics at the U.S. Military Academy in West Point, followed by a teaching position at the National War College. In 1987, he retired as an Army colonel and later pursued a career in investment banking. He maintains connection with the military through his involvement with several organizations, such as the Medal of Honor Foundation, of which he is vice chairman. Coming up, this week's Profiles in Valor.
This has been Veterans Chronicles, produced by Radio America and the American Veterans Center. Veterans Chronicles is available wherever you are. Log on to www.radioamerica.org and click on the podcasting icon. Look for Veterans Chronicles and follow the information on your screen to subscribe to our podcast.